in America, we legislate reproductive rights, but laws are black and white, and the lives of women are a thousand shades of gray.
From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook.
When women don't speak, when women aren't listened to, other people create narratives for them.
Today, we're talking to New York Times best-selling author Jodi Picou, who's out with a new book, A Spark of Light.
The way that we begin to take back our narrative is for women to step forward and to say, yes, this is my story.
In A Spark of Light, a gunman enters a reproductive health clinic in Mississippi and takes people hostage. With a varied cast of characters, the story unfolds from there and tackles issues of race, morality, and women's health. We spoke with Picou about her new novel and also about the process that goes into writing her books, which often deal with hard moral or ethical dilemmas. We discussed how she first became a novelist and the hard, unexpected road to success. And of course, we talked politics and what President Trump might be able to learn from reading her books.
We need to move as a group, as a nation, beyond the conversation of Roe versus Wade. We need to actually just take it off the table. How do you then solve this? How do you reduce the abortion rate?
Stay tuned for our conversation with Jodi Picou. On the podcast, we'll be bringing you real talk with women bosses, asking how did you make it and what advice would you give a woman looking to lead? If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @apalmerdc. Women Rule is produced by Politico in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. And now, our interview with Jodi Picou. Jodi, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
It is my pleasure.
We're talking with you as you're in Washington, D.C., as part of your book tour for your newly released work, A Spark of Light. So let's start with that.
Yep.
It's a fictional novel, but it tackles a lot of politically relevant topics, reproductive rights, abortion. Without giving away any spoilers, everybody buy the book. We tell you right in that now. But tell our listeners a bit about it and what inspired you to write it.
Sure. So A Spark of Light is a story that takes place in Mississippi at a fictional abortion clinic. It is the only clinic in the state that is true, actually, in Mississippi, but I fictionalized the clinic. And a gunman comes into the clinic one day with a weapon and a grudge, and he starts shooting. And he kills a bunch of employees and a bunch of patients, and the rest he takes hostage. And one of the hostages is a 15-year-old girl who happens to be the daughter of the hostage negotiator that is outside, unbeknownst to him at the time. And the book, in I hope an interesting way, spirals backward in time so that you start at the very end and every chapter moves back an hour until you learn what brought all of these very diverse people to the clinic on this day at this time. The reason that I wrote the book actually started when I was in college. I had a friend who had an abortion. She was 7 weeks pregnant with an unwanted pregnancy. She and her boyfriend had a lot of tearful nights and made the decision, and I supported them 100%. Years later, I was pregnant with my third child, and I too was 7 weeks pregnant and had a complication. And I was told I might lose the baby, and I was devastated because to me, that was already a baby. And I wondered how I could hold both of those thoughts in my head at the same time. How my friend could be 7 weeks pregnant and I could support abortion, but I could be 7 weeks pregnant and not want one. And it made me realize that in our country, where we fall on that spectrum isn't even just about being pro-life and pro-choice, because an individual woman may change her mind over the course of her own lifetime. What you believe at 14 is not what you believe at 30, which is not what you believe at 50. And in America, we legislate reproductive rights, but laws are black and white, and the lives of women are a thousand shades of gray. And that was really what made me want to write the book.
Tell us a little bit about the research that went into this book. Doing your due diligence is something I do a lot of, right, as a reporter, fact-checking, making
right.
sure there's no inaccuracies.
Sure.
Is it different for you as a novelist?
No. In fact, I've been told I make a really good journalist. I do a lot of research. Sometimes I spend more time doing research than I do with the physical writing of a book. So the research for this was quite comprehensive and started with facts because I needed to know the basic facts about abortion statistics in the U.S., that 1 out of 4 women will have an abortion in the course of her lifetime, that 88% of those happen in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy, that 7 out of 10 women who have an abortion make less than $22,000 a year, and that 75% of women who have abortions cite economic reasons for that. I then dove a little deeper into laws because there have been, since 2012, over 280 laws to restrict abortion rights at the state level. And of course, that's why we all get nervous when we talk about overturning Roe versus Wade. Right now, there are 7 states in the United States that have 1 abortion clinic. 89% of counties don't have any clinic at all. So I learned a lot about these laws, and there are so many, but, you know, the one in 2016, for example, the trap laws that started in Texas, where they said that all clinics had to have a surgical suite in case there was a complication from an abortion. Now, when you have an abortion, 0.3% of abortions have complications. Among other things that are more complicated than abortions are liposuction, vasectomy, colonoscopies, and having a baby. But, you know, before they could overturn that law, it had done its damage, and 20 of the 40 clinics in Texas closed and remain closed. So once I was armed with all these facts and all this research, it's a lot. But then I dove in meeting the people who are on the forefront of this issue. I started by talking to people who are abortion providers. And I did start in the Northeast where I live, where it is relatively easy to get an abortion. But then I moved down south and I was very fortunate to be connected with Dr. Willie Parker. Willie is a tremendous feminist and an abortion provider. He also happens to be an African-American man who is a devout Christian, who says that he performs abortions not in spite of his religion, but because of it. He was listening to this parable of the Good Samaritan at church and he thought, if I don't provide for these women, who will? And he's an incredible guy, and he invited me to come down and shadow him. So I went to Alabama and Mississippi, and I worked with him for a few days. And I had the privilege of being in a room as 3 abortions were being performed, an 8-week abortion, a 5-week abortion, and a 15-week abortion. And, you know, there were the 5-week abortion and the 8-week abortion were less than 3 minutes. In the products of conception, there was nothing that would really give you pause. And Willie Parker was pretty vehement about the fact that we do need to look at that, and we can't use euphemisms. We should support what's happening without euphemisms and be very well aware of what we're doing, because it's still worthy of women having a choice. That's the way he thinks about it. And so those first 2 abortions, not so bad. But then the 15-week abortion was a little different. It took 7 minutes, and there were things that, you know, you look at that kind of look a little human, very tiny and human. And that gave me pause. But I then spoke to the woman who was getting that abortion. She had 3 children under the age of 4. She couldn't afford to feed them as it was, and she knew she wouldn't be able to if she had another child. So does that make her a really, really bad mom or a really, really good one? Then I moved to the other side of the aisle because I needed to talk to people who are pro-life as well. And I did go in there with the misconception that people who are pro-life, who think differently than I do, must be evangelical and zealots, and they weren't. They were really lovely people who I would have had as friends, who just believe with deep compassion and conviction that life begins at conception and don't know how else to process that. And it was really important for me to realize that I had judged them without listening to them, because that's a mistake that we all make. And finally, I spoke to 151 women who had terminated a pregnancy. Of those 151, 1 regretted it. The rest all thought about it every single day.
Wow. I just got goosebumps. So for those that might not be entirely familiar with your work, I want to talk a little bit more broadly. You have 25 books under your belt, and they all tend to focus on really kind of socially controversial, hard topics. You've written about teen suicide, high school shootings, sexual abuse. What is it you think that draws you to these kind of ethical and moral fiction and these kind of hard societal challenges that we're facing?
I think that for me, it's a way to process something that's bothering me. If I write about a book, it's usually because there's an issue that's keeping me up at night that I'm worrying about as a woman, as an American, as a mother. If it keeps bugging me, I usually wind up writing a whole novel about it. And the act of writing the novel for me, as you can hear from all the research, is really me taking all the different sides of an issue and laying them out. I don't ever want to tell people what to think. I do want to give them the resources to hear from the other side for the first time. I think that's my job as a fiction writer. But the other thing I really love about fiction is that very often you can get someone to consider a difficult and controversial topic that they wouldn't otherwise consider through a nonfiction lens. You know, when I was writing about school shootings, I read the FBI report on school shooters. I'm guessing most people did not. Right. But that's okay, because I did it for them, and I could take all of those statistics and build characters around them so that you are learning the truths that I learned.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk to you about how you came to be a really prolific best-selling author. I've read a lot of your books with movies based on your books. Talk to me about your childhood. I've listened to some of the interviews where you said outright that you had a really happy childhood on Long Island.
I was going to say, this is where the podcast grinds to a halt, because I had a really boring childhood.
And then in New Hampshire, you know, having this kind of unusual, you know, a lot of authors, something happened when they're younger, yeah. and then that kind of fuels their artistic process.
Yeah.
How did you get from that to kind of becoming a writer?
So I love to write. I've written my whole life. My mom still has a book I wrote when I was 5 years old, you know, and I did have all this happiness and this, you know, a really great childhood. I didn't have the anguish that most people have when they become writers. So when I got to college and I was taking creative writing courses and I was told, write what you know, I realized very quickly I knew absolutely nothing. And I decided, well, then I'm just going to write what I want to learn. And that's kind of really been my modus operandi for 25 years.
So you didn't become a novelist right out of the gate, though, right?
No, I had 2 years where, let's see, I worked on Wall Street for 3 months until the stock market crashed. I moved to Boston and I got a master's in education. I worked as the second person at a two-person ad agency. I taught creative writing and I taught eighth grade English, and I got married and I got pregnant, all in 2 years. Yeah, so then finally I became a novelist after my first child was born.
So talk about that though. That's kind of a lot of this podcast is a lot of women taking chances. And
yeah.
I'm sure there was people questioning your husband, your family potentially, saying, a novelist, huh? Like, okay,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I had my first short story published when I was in college, actually. And I called my mom up and said, I'm going to be a writer, when I got the call from 17 Magazine. And she said, that is so great. Who is going to support you? So it was a good reality check. She's my biggest fan, but still. You know, I was really fortunate because when I started to write full time, I was the primary caretaker of my children. I had an incredibly supportive husband. I still do. And I was making no money and no ripple in the literary world whatsoever. You know, four people were reading my books. But my husband really knew how important it was to me. So he would go off to work all day long. I would take care of the kids. He would come home at 6 o'clock. I would throw the children at him and I would write until 10 at night. And, you know, the real question for me is not how did you become a writer, but how are you still married, which I am quite happily, you know. And I'm really lucky that he recognized that that was important to me. And that fed my soul because it allowed me to slowly build a fan base to the point where, you know, I do have success now and I do have people who are waiting to hear what I have to say.
Talk about that. When did you realize it wasn't just going to be kind of you sitting in the spare bedroom typing and, you know, your mom and your friends reading your books to, it was not only going to be lucrative, but like a smashing success?
I don't know, like yesterday? No, you know, it's funny because we still, when something really great happens, my husband and I still sort of do this silly little jig in the kitchen together because it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. But, you know, you don't ever lose sight of how fortunate you are because the odds are definitely stacked against you, you know, if you go into writing. I will say that I still remember when My Sister's Keeper was published. Everyone assumes that was a huge hit, and it was not. It got as high as number 7 on the New York Times list, but it was my first book on the New York Times list. And I was a nobody at a very big publishing house then. And there was not a lot of marketing money and not a lot of resources were put behind the book. It really sold on the strength of word of mouth. And when people at the publishing house saw where it landed on the list, they were like, wait, what? Who is this person? We own her? We publish her? And that they suddenly began to direct more resources toward me. But I really credit my readers with that, because they were the ones who, for all those books before, had said, oh, I read this last book, you're going to love this, read the next one, and grew my fan base. But that was really the first time I thought, okay, maybe I don't have to go get a job application at Home Depot. Yeah.
Do you ever have writer's block?
No, I don't believe in writer's block. I'll tell you why. Because I started writing when I had babies, little tiny babies. And when you have kids, you don't have any time. So you write anytime you get. You write when Barney is on TV or when they're not hitting each other with blocks. You take your laptop to swim practice and to nursery school pickup, and you type before your kid comes out. And even after the most amazing invention, which was an 8-hour school day, you know, when I had all this time to work, I still function the same way.
Did your life change all at once you had this kind of, you know, bestseller on the New York Times list? What was some of the biggest changes?
I can't say that life changed dramatically. You know, I remember there was a point where we put an addition on our house that was super exciting for us. You know, but that was years after that. We live in New England. We're relatively, you know, quiet people. And I don't think... We don't live high on the hog. We are very fortunate in that we can take vacations with our family and really do stuff that we want to do at the drop of a hat. I love that. I guess it's the trappings of success that make you feel really comfortable, which are lovely. But it's not anything I expected, because the odds are just so strong against you. You know, I very easily could have been a successful writer who still had to have a second job, you know, to pay my half of the mortgage, for example.
We've talked a lot about discrimination women face in plenty of industries. But I was wondering what you thought about that in the literary world.
Yes. Thank you. So I'm really outspoken about this, actually, and I have been called out for it. And I'm also on the board of VITA, which is a group that now crunches numbers to look at gender discrimination in publishing. And what they have found is that, yes, absolutely, there is gender discrimination. Not only are fewer women reviewed by traditional publications, but there are fewer female reviewers. And when you open that lens up to include non-binary writers or trans writers or writers of color, the odds get even worse. Big surprise. But they were the first ones to actually create statistics. And that was really important, because there were several women writers who were arguing that there was gender discrimination in publishing. And we had male writers saying, I don't know what they're complaining about.
Right.
Because if a woman opens her mouth, she's complaining, of course. And I say that with irony.
Yes,
but,
yes.
But, you know, I think it's really important to know that as a result of those numbers and of the counts that VITA does every year, we have seen progress in some of these outlets. We have seen at least an attempt towards parity. And that is so cool. There are some that are still not doing a very good job. But, you know, they're being called out now. And I think once someone actually calls you out with statistics and numbers, it's on you to fix it.
Another topic we've talked at length about on this podcast is dealing with public criticism and how women deal with it. How do you deal with a negative book review or reviews that, for, you know, instance, write you off as chick lit or unserious?
So I find that fascinating, because I support all kinds of writing. I read all kinds of genres. And I have so many friends who are phenomenal writers, who are romance writers and chick lit writers. I just do not happen to be one of those. And I find it fascinating that I am called a women's fiction writer when 50% of my fan mail comes from men. And you never hear anyone called a men's fiction writer, right? Why is that? Why is it that we expect men to only read men, but we expect women to read both female and male authors? What I have tended to discover is that when someone calls you a women's fiction author, it has much less to do with your book and much more to do with what is between your legs. And, you know, that I think is a gross misconception. My favorite story from last year was that my book, Small Great Things, which is about racism in America and is extremely heavy and intense and topical and does not have a single kiss in it, was voted the best romance novel in Poland. So I don't know what they're reading for romance in Poland, but, you know, go figure.
There you go. Before we sign off, I want to turn to politics. We're Politico. You've been outspoken about the current state of U.S. politics and President Trump. And in 2016, after you had come out with a book addressing racism and white supremacy, which we were just talking about, you said in an interview that Trump supporters need my book.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that for Small Great Things, that is a book about racism, but in particular, it's really directed towards people who look like me, white people, who are less likely to understand that racism is not just prejudice, but prejudice and power. We live in a country where being white gives you power. And if you as a white person do not understand that there are privileges that come to you as a result of systemic racism, then you are part of the problem. And that's really what that book addresses. I would like to add to that and say perhaps Brett Kavanaugh could read A Spark of Light, because that's really about women's reproductive rights. And I think it's extremely important that we recognize what happens when women don't have a voice. I interviewed 151 women. Of those women, 25 were willing to be acknowledged in the book, the majority only by an initial or anonymous or a pseudonym, because they had never told their employers, their friends, their parents, their spouses, their children that they had had an abortion. And they are living under an umbrella of stigma and shame. When women don't speak, when women aren't listened to, other people create narratives for them. And it is usually one of blame and shame. And that's something that I think we see a lot when it comes to abortions. And the way that we begin to normalize this, the way that we begin to take back our narrative, is for women to step forward and to say, yes, this is my story. This is why I did it. And not everyone is in a place to do that. I totally recognize that. But if you are and you feel strong enough and you can say something, you might give courage to another woman to come forward.
Well, and we've certainly, I think, through the Kavanaugh kind of saga, we have seen more and more women coming forward.
Exactly.
You said before we started recording that you were doing some stuff with Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the activism that you have around this, you know, kind of beyond the book?
Yeah, sure. I think that what's really important for me is, having looked at both sides very equally and represented them, I think, very, very equally in the book, I've come to the conclusion that we are never going to agree on this topic. And so with that said, I really think it's important to recognize that we need to move as a group, as a nation, beyond the conversation of Roe versus Wade. We need to actually just take it off the table. Let's not talk about overturning it. Let's not talk about it at all. How do you then solve this? How do you reduce the abortion rate? Because nobody ever wants to have an abortion. It's in everyone's best interest to do that. And, you know, the easiest way to do it is through contraception and sex ed. We know in multiple studies that have been done globally, the more access you have to both of those and the freer the contraception is, the more you see a decline in abortion rates. And Planned Parenthood, of course, is a tremendous outlet for that. 97% of their work has nothing to do with abortion care. You know, 97% of their work is about giving out contraception and STD screenings and cancer screenings and women's reproductive health. And that is the part of Planned Parenthood that is federally funded. The only part of Planned Parenthood that is not federally funded, that literally pays for itself, is abortion care. So for everyone who is shouting to defund Planned Parenthood, what they're really saying is all of those services provided to women who cannot necessarily access them with their own money because of their own financial situation, those all go away. It will not stop abortions. In fact, the only thing Planned Parenthood will do if you defund it is abortions, which is a ridiculous irony. And what it really means is defund Planned Parenthood and you have once again compromised women's health care. And that's something that I didn't recognize until I began to do the research and that I think everyone needs to know.
Well, lastly, I want to end on a look towards your creative future. Mm-hmm. What's next from Jodi?
So I have already started the research for another book, which I will write sometime this winter, which is much more of a kind of emotionally introspective book that asks, who would you be if you weren't who you are now? What if your life had taken a slightly different path, one other turn? I've also become a librettist, and I have been working on adaptations of a YA series that I wrote called Between the Lines, which will be off Broadway in New York this summer. And I am currently helping to write the libretto of The Book Thief.
Well, congratulations.
Thank
you. You got a lot on your plate.
I do, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me.
Women Rule is produced by Rena Flores. Dave Shaw is our executive producer, and our booker is Jessica Andrews. If you're a fan of the show and you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. And one last thing. If you have any thoughts about who we should feature on Women Rule, let me know. Tweet me at @apalmerdc. And of course, hit that subscribe button. And thanks for listening.